Action Phase. I'm your host, Tegan Keating. This week, I talk with Natalie Lefkovich, the CEO of the Health Federation of Philadelphia. The Health Federation is the network of health center, community health centers in the city of Philadelphia. And basically, it exists so that they can talk to each other and share best practices and all that great stuff. Natalie has been working for the Health Federation for the past 30 years, so she's seen this organization grow from having only 4 employees when it started to more than 80 now. And it's fascinating to talk to somebody who has such a broad perspective on health in the city of Philadelphia. So it's a great conversation, and I think you'll enjoy it. So here you go, Natalie Lefkovich. I'm here with Natalie Lefkovich, the CEO of the Health Federation of Philadelphia. How are you, Natalie?
Okay, thank you.
Thanks so much for making time for me
today. Absolutely, my pleasure.
In this very warm conference room. So that's why you might hear some street noise, because we have to have the windows open in December to keep us from sweating. So will you start off by telling me a little bit about the Health Federation and what it does and why it exists and all that good stuff?
Okay. I'll try to be concise in that description. The Health Federation was founded 30 years ago as a nonprofit public health organization, organized primarily to create a structure for the consortium of community health centers in the Philadelphia region. The community health centers provide preventive and primary care services to traditionally underserved populations. And prior to the formation of the Health Federation, there was really no structure for them to communicate or collaborate or coordinate with each other. So it was thought that there was some opportunity for synergy and efficiency in the creation of a federation. So we are a membership organization of community health centers. Our mission, like that of the health centers, is to improve the access, the quality, the scope of primary and public health services available to the population of this region. And we carry out that mission by a lot of direct capacity building work and program development work with our member health centers, partnerships with the Philadelphia Department of Public Health, local universities, other nonprofit members of the public health sector, and providing a number of advocacy and capacity building opportunities.
So the Health Federation is a separate entity.
Correct.
From the health centers. From the health centers.
That's right.
It's the network that encompasses
exactly
all of them. And how many health centers are there?
Well, there are in the Philadelphia region 17 organizations, mm-hmm, that are community health centers, that are FQH, federally qualified health centers. Of those, there are 14 that are members of the Health Federation, and they collectively operate 41 sites of care.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Serving in excess of 300,000 people a year.
Wow.
It's kind of a big deal.
Yeah. That's a lot of
yes,
care.
Yes, it's a lot
provided
of care, and it represents, as I say, of the 300,000+ individuals, about 40% are uninsured.
Okay.
And most of the rest are insured under Medicaid. Mm-hmm. So the patients assigned to community health centers represent about 25% of the total Medicaid population of the region.
That's actually a smaller number than I would have expected.
Well, it's a pretty poor city, so there are a lot of people who qualify for Medicaid.
Right.
Regrettably, since we have not expanded Medicaid under the Affordable Care Act in this state, there could be a lot more people who benefit from having coverage.
Is that part of the advocacy efforts?
It is. It is, among a variety of other topics, but currently, of course, that is a front burner issue for us, working both directly with individuals and other organizations to enroll as many people as we can in various available insurance products, and at the same time to advocate for the expansion, the reasonable expansion of Medicaid in Pennsylvania. So that everyone who was intended to be covered by the Affordable Care Act, in fact, can be.
And how's that going, that effort?
The enrollment effort is going pretty well. There's a lot of interest. There's a lot of need. There are a lot of people who want the assistance and seek and accept the assistance to enroll. And now that some of the major technological glitches have been worked out, we're providing direct service to hundreds of people,
which is great. Like,
yeah,
how
it's
many
fabulous.
How many people in Philadelphia are uninsured, ballpark?
I know that number. Do I have it on the top of my head? Is it something like 120,000?
Wow.
I think that's don't hold me to that, but I think that's the ballpark.
That's a lot of people.
Yep. Yep.
So it's a good thing that there are so many sites.
There are a lot of sites, and we will continue, those sites will continue to provide services to people with or without insurance. Obviously, it is in everyone's interest, consumers and providers alike, if people do have insurance.
Right, right.
Because it supports the capacity of the provider organizations to do more for more people. And it also helps consumers to have access to the full continuum of care. Because while health centers are funded to provide primary care to people regardless of ability to pay, for those without insurance, there are still financial barriers to accessing other levels of care, specialty care,
right,
pharmaceuticals, and the like.
So if you go in and you have a blood test done in a health center and comes up that you have diabetes and you need to see a specialist, that isn't covered as part of all of this.
Well, in that example, diabetes is managed in primary care.
So and bad example.
So that, of course, falls under kind of routine chronic disease management. And, and those patients would continue to see their providers in a community health center.
Okay. So something more less commonplace than diabetes
That's right. I mean, even people who are managed in primary care need from time to time, depending on the acuity of their illness, to see an endocrinologist, for instance, or a cardiologist, or
a podiatrist,
and so forth. And health centers do a pretty good job of advocating and getting access to those services for their patients. But it's less systematic, it's less predictable, it's less seamless, if you will, for people without insurance.
Right, which is why it's so important to get people insured.
Absolutely.
So let's shift a little bit and talk about you and how your background and how you got interested and involved in public health and all that good stuff.
Okay. Well, my background is that I have worked at the Health Federation for 30 years. So I am a...
You're a lifer.
Yeah, I'm a lifer. I wish. Certainly am an example of someone who has learned the content on the job.
Okay.
And there's a lot of content to be learned, especially over, you know, 30 years. There are a lot of both system issues and public health issues that have emerged, shifted, changed priority, new research that illuminates a new opportunity to improve the health of the population. So it's continuous learning.
When you say systems, can you define that for us?
Systems meaning the delivery systems.
Okay.
Business environment in which healthcare operates, public policies, appropriation or allocation of funds for various priorities that shifts from time to time. So there's a kind of constant shifting, tweaking, learning about how best to solve the problem of improving the health of the public.
Because the problems are constantly changing.
The problems shift from time to time, of course, but also what we know evolves over time. Mm. What we know about what works, what we know on the basis of research findings as well as practical experience. So based on innovations or new best practices. So it's a moving target.
Does that make it kind of fun?
Of course.
Yeah.
Of course. I mean, it would be, I'm not a person who could keep a job for 30 years if I were doing the same thing for 30 years or working on the same single issue for 30 years.
That is an interesting point, because I guess you get to look at lots of different issues. It's not necessarily becoming a specialist in
one
health issue.
I think I'm pretty much a quintessential generalist, as a matter of fact. And of course, in my position in the organization, there is keeping up with the things we've just talked about, you know, kind of the content of both the public health and structural content of the work. Mm-hmm. But this organization, as an organization, has also evolved and grown. So there's the kind of internal focus as well,
okay,
which changes over time. When I came 30 years ago, we had a staff of four.
Wow.
And a budget of about $200,000 a year. We now have a staff of, I don't know, 80-ish.
Wow.
And a budget of $19 million. So, that's, you know, that's a lot of change,
that's
too.
That's a lot of growth. So, that's great.
Yeah.
And I know from, you know, looking around on the website, the Health Federation does a lot of things that aren't necessarily just supporting the health centers.
That's correct. They are supporting the health centers directly, or they are supporting the mission of improving the lives, the opportunities in traditionally underserved communities.
Mm-hmm.
So that can be done directly through provision of direct services to the client, mm-hmm. to the resident, to the end user. It can also be done by working on improving the efficiency and efficacy of service delivery and systems-level work, policy-level work, capacity building, workforce competency development through training, you know, and so forth. So there are lots of levels of activity that all contribute ultimately to the improvement of the efficiency and efficacy of public health services.
It sounds like because public health problems have lots of causes, mm-hmm. that the Health Federation is able to kind of like get at problems from lots of different directions.
That's what we try to do. See the whole picture.
Right.
And fit the pieces together. So I would say that we are a public health mission-driven problem solver. How's that?
You should have that as your motto. So is that how you got interested in public health, by wanting to solve those problems when you came here 30 years ago?
I would say that kind of going way back, that as a very young person, I became quite involved in the civil rights movement. And I have always ideologically been motivated by issues of equity and justice. So there are, a few ways in which a society reveals its values around equity.
Mm-hmm.
And access to health care is not the only one, but certainly an important one.
Right.
And so I think driven by, kind of my the causes of my youth, if you will,
mm-hmm.
Combined with my general interest in health and healthcare, took me first into corporate life.
Really?
And yep, I worked for about 11 years in various levels of management in the commercial health insurance industry.
Oh.
And I was good at, organizational management and problem solving in that context, but it didn't really speak to mission.
Mm.
So the shift to what was then a startup organization where I could embrace the mission and, bring my both mission and practical skills to bear. I was an English major, by the way, so
okay.
I know how to write mm-hmm. and kind of be analytical in a verbal way, in a way that communicates my point of view to others. And so that was another piece of another ingredient in that mix. And I mention that only because it's those are kind of important skills in a startup enterprise where there aren't enough resources or enough people with specialty expertise to delegate. So it calls for a generalist
mm-hmm.
who can synthesize information, communicate it back in a way that describes the problem, proposes a solution, generates grant funding, etc.
Right.
So.
Speaking of grants, how did you, if you were an English major in college, did you pick up the financial
nope.
piece of all this?
Nope.
On the job?
Yep.
Okay.
Pretty
that's,
much.
That's good to know.
Mm-hmm.
That
I mean, as I said, I had come from corporate, so I
right.
wasn't completely blind to the role that budgeting and revenue
mm-hmm.
and bottom line plays in making decisions about products and operations and marketing and so forth. But I wasn't directly involved in or responsible for any of that part of the corporate business.
Mm-hmm.
And so I certainly didn't bring any particular expertise in that regard to this job.
But you've obviously picked it up. Since then.
Yeah, well, the focus is for me is not on, obviously I have to manage responsibly within a budget and, so forth, but the focus really is on the work.
Mm.
And if the work is worthy and you can communicate its worthiness, then that's how you raise the money. And to support the work.
Right.
And so it's kind of a cycle, but it's driven by the mission and the quality of the work, not by the goal of fundraising as a freestanding
right.
goal. It's the mechanism to support the work, not the other way around.
Right. Because that, I think, can get lost sometimes.
Absolutely. We're very selective. We only go after money that will support work that we are doing or want to do or builds on competencies that we already have as a kind of organic growth.
So can you give me an idea of what a typical day looks like for you?
Oh, goodness. That's... it's tough to tell you that and make it interesting because because if I told you the literal how I spend my day, it would involve spending a lot of time in my email and a lot of time in meetings.
Ugh.
And some time writing about ideas generated or tasks generated from those meetings and emails. Which doesn't really reveal much to you. But typically, one of the things that makes my days fun is, of course, first and foremost, the fact that the work is purposeful. I mm-hmm. believe in the purpose of the work. Okay. So, but the other thing is that in a single day, there's rarely a day where I'm working on one thing.
Okay.
Or on one project. So I might be spending time with a program manager internal here, a program manager who is developing a training strategy for some purpose. Mm-hmm. And 2 hours later, when I finished with that conversation, I'm off to a meeting talking about an entirely different content area.
Mm-hmm.
And then I may be running back to the office and preparing materials for a board meeting, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of switching my brain from topic to topic and picking up where I last left off with that topic.
Mm-hmm.
Multiple times a day.
So that
it's fun. It's exciting.
Yeah, it like keeps everything fresh.
Yep.
You don't have one day that looks exactly right. like right. the day before.
Exactly.
That is very cool.
It can be challenging. It can be exhausting because it's pretty
sure.
intense to keep switching kind of what you're focusing on.
Mm-hmm.
But as you say, it also keeps it fresh and it keeps each day as a kind of dynamic exercise.
Yeah, and what strikes me as really interesting about that kind of day is that you are constantly exposed to different people who
yes.
have different ideas. You're not stuck here in this office talking to the same people all the time. You really get to kind of mix it up.
That's true. That you know, I have what is it? 7 direct reports.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't talk to each of them by every day by any means, but I certainly talk to each of them within the course of a week.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, we have a lot of external partners. So whether I'm interacting with them in a meeting or by telephone or by email, there is a lot of interaction. Yes. And I don't like to work from home, even though there are some things that I could perfectly well accomplish from home. But I actually prefer to be here.
Mm-hmm.
I find it more structured and more stimulating and more opportunistic because there are things that happen in the moment where I can engage in the conversation.
Right.
Or stick in my 2 cents. That would not be possible if I were, at home with my laptop.
Right. Yeah. And that's kind of, there's been a shift in some corporations now to mm-hmm. minimize that working from home
mm-hmm.
because that is so important to get everybody in the same place because that's where ideas come from
right.
and how you solve problems
right.
and things like that.
Yeah. I'm a big fan of reasonable flexibility. So, there's no one here who works virtually,
mm-hmm.
But there are certainly people here who from time to time take a day to work from home.
Mm-hmm.
If they're going to be on, a couple of conference calls or webinars and in between they're working on a document that they're composing and they can do it just as well from home, in fact, maybe better without the ambient distractions
mm-hmm.
of the workplace, then that's fine. Or if people have personal or family issues that require a little bit of flexibility, an afternoon that really, they have to be at home, but they can still work from home.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a big fan of that, of allowing people that kind of flexibility,
mm-hmm.
Because at the end of the day, what I care about is their work product,
mm-hmm.
not their physical location or circumstances.
Mm-hmm.
There is no one who works entirely from home because, as you say, I think that there is enormous value to being together in the workplace. And frankly, there's also an equity issue. There are some job types that can't be done from home.
Mm.
You know, if you're in direct client service, you can't work from home. If you're the front desk receptionist, you can't work from home. So, you know, I think it keeps it fair, if you will, among other things, among other, you know, criteria. If everyone is treated with a degree of flexibility, but, you know, everyone has more or less the same work rules.
Right. And it also sounds like having that flexibility helps create a workplace that understands that sometimes there are things that have to get done that aren't here. Sometimes.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, there are, as I say, you know, what we care about is the work getting done?
Mm-hmm.
Is it getting done well, on time? Is it of high quality? Is it creative? Is it collaborative? Is it effective? And that's, you know, at the end of the day, what's important.
Right.
The rest is all a matter of organizational culture.
Right.
And the organizational culture around here is such that people like working here. We have very, very little turnover. Mm. And to me, that's a real barometer of how valued people feel, how comfortable and safe they feel in the workplace, the degree to which they feel personally gratified by the work they're doing, how much they value and trust the relationships that they have in the workplace, and so forth. So I'm pretty proud of that particular little fact.
Yeah, that's really good for everyone who's working here. Not so great for those of us who are going to be on the job market pretty soon.
Well, since we grow from time to time, you know, we do hire new people, even mm-hmm. though we don't lose old people.
Right.
That's how we got from 4 to 80.
I guess that's true.
So,
as we wrap up, do you have any advice for people who are interested in becoming generalists and that's kind of the path that they see themselves taking?
I think that it's fine to be a generalist in terms of having content interest in a lot of different things. But I think it's important to develop some skills,
mm-hmm.
not content expertise, although content expertise is going to be necessary depending on where you land in your career. But it's really important to know how to write, how to think critically,
mm-hmm.
How to convey your thoughts in a clear and compelling way, how to structure a productive meeting, how to manage a project. You know, those kinds of process skills are critical regardless of where they're applied, to what content area, to what population or disease or, you know, research question.
Mm-hmm.
And there are certainly certain things that you need to know if you're going to be a public health professional. You don't have to be a researcher, but you have to understand something about the integrity of research.
Right.
You know, you have to understand that public health really is at its heart, a collaborative discipline. So understanding how to convene or include a multiplicity of voices
mm-hmm.
in solving a problem or even identifying the problem. Those are the kinds of things that you really need to hone.
Mm-hmm.
And having a clear sense of purpose. You know, I think the people who are most effective in public health are those who, for whom it is not a job. It really is, you know, a strongly held belief system.
That's a tall order. But thank you very much
for
talking with me. And thanks.
Okay.
Natalie Lefkovich. She is, you can just hear the passion in her voice when she talks about these things. Like, she has really dedicated her life to ensuring that Philadelphians can access healthcare whenever they need it, regardless of their insurance status. So she's kind of a great role model for those of us who are starting our careers. How we can think about what our careers in public health are going to look like, you know, rather than taking kind of a tunnel vision view of, I'm going to be the world's foremost expert on pancreatic cancer. Maybe thinking about, like, how does the system work and what can I do to help fix the system could be an option, and just something to think about. As usual, you can find Action Phase on Twitter at @ActionPhasePod. You can also send me an email, actionphasepodcast@gmail.com. And I am always accessible on Twitter at Tegan Keating, TEAGANKEATING. And my website is TeganK.com, so TEAGAN, the letter K.com. I appreciate you listening, and I will talk to you next week. Bye.